Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Tuesday marked the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote nationwide. But what it also did was give women the right and duty to serve on juries, to be assessed for taxes, and most importantly, to run for and hold public office. It didn't take long for women to run and win elections, but there weren't many. Even today, there are far fewer women holding elective positions than men. Today, we discuss the history of women who were running in Pennsylvania, and the challenges many women still face. Joining us on today's program is Dana Brown, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women and Politics at Chatham University. Professor Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also, retired Republican State Senator Pat Vance of Cumberland County. Senator Vance, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Democratic State Representative Patty Kim of Dauphin County. Representative, always good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be here.
And also joining us is Dr. Curtis Miner. He's a senior history curator at the State Museum of Pennsylvania and has written and is part of exhibits having to do with women's suffrage at the State Museum of Pennsylvania this year. Dr. Miner, good to have you on the show today.
Good morning, Scott. Nice to be back on the show.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I'm going to start with Kurt Miner. And yes, I am very cognizant of the fact that my first questions will be going to a man on this program. But Kurt Miner, you've written and done a lot of research on women who ran for office after suffrage, which was the name of what is being celebrated at the State Museum of Pennsylvania. 1920, known best for women getting the right to vote, but they also could run for office. Did women run in that first year here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, actually, surprisingly, yes. It's August 1920. You've missed out on the primaries, but nonetheless, a few women tried to pull it together and mount campaigns in the fall election of 1920 to show that they could do it. Famously, one woman who ran for office in that general election had been a former silent sentinel. She was from Scranton. Her name was last name was Heffelfinger. She tried to organize a campaign, but she had to run it as an independent because she didn't have party backing because she had missed out on the primary. It was very instructive in the need to have an organized approach to running for office, which they didn't have in 1920. So she lost, not surprisingly.
Were there any women who won in that first year, 1920?
No, not in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. There were a number who did. Mounted scattered campaigns, but they were unable to win election.
So 1922 was really a big year for women candidates. But before 1922, before we even talk about that, there was a movement going on, particularly in Philadelphia, to teach women candidates how to run for office. Actually, because the right to vote was new, they were even being taught how to vote, correct?
Absolutely. And this is where we have to talk about the emergence of the Pennsylvania League of Women Voters, which was a state chapter of a national organization, which is the successor organization to, in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Women's Suffrage Association. It emerges immediately after the 19th Amendment is ratified, actually a little bit before, because they were anticipating getting the vote. And they realize it's important. Once you have the right to vote, to exercise it requires you to understand the electoral process. So the League of Women Voters emerges in 1920. They spend the next 2 years educating women on the mechanics of voting. And they take as their mission statement, effectively, to increase the effectiveness of women and and also to further better government. That's sort of their two-prong approach. And they play a critical role in 1922, which they couldn't do in 1920, which is getting women acculturated to the political process, getting them registered to vote and out to vote, and also encouraging them to run for office.
How many did run for office in 1922?
That's really quite interesting. I want to just back up and give this a little bit of a national context. In 1922, the results of the just elections across the country, there are 26 women who win office, state legislative office in 17 states. It's important to note Pennsylvania is leading the pack with 8, but I'm getting a little bit ahead of the story because in 1922, there are 35 women back in spring who run in the primaries, about 20 of them win, and then 20 of those women then go into the general election, and that's where we get our important figure of 8 women who win state legislative seats in fall of 1922.
In Pennsylvania?
Yes.
And they were split along party lines, right?
Well, actually not. This is what's kind of interesting.
I thought they were.
The women, all of the women who win office in that, and they're, by the way, they are dubbed by the League of Women Voters who are cheering them on, the Keystone Eight. And if that has a resonance as a kind of cohort, think of today's politics and, you know, U.S. Congress, we have a squad that has been identified of a handful of women who are united ideologically. The League of Women Voters saw these 8 women, all white, by the way, which is not surprising, of course, in the 1920s, but all Republican, as a potential women's bloc, very small as a percentage, less than 5%, but clearly very visible because they are pioneers. But Scott, they're united by party. However, in every other way, they're divided. Half of them are from rural districts, half are from urban districts, half are from the West, half are from the East. And half of them are married, half are single, half of them are a little bit older, a few younger. So it's a real mixed bag of women representing truly the diversity of the state, despite the fact that they are all Republican and obviously all women.
The press played this up in a not-so-serious way. In fact, they even joked about what you call the newly elected women legislators.
Yes.
They commented on their appearances, or at least some of their appearances. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know whether the male legislators would be able to continue to smoke. And this was at a time where there were spittoons in the Capitol as well. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, the underlying chauvinism, as they would have called it back then, this is prior to the use of sexism, but the chauvinism was on full display. You have to remember that in the 1920s, especially compared to today, the state house, especially, was a male-only club, very much dominated by men who were, many of them, attached to urban political machines. It was a rough-and-tumble affair of the day, and there was a great concern that women, if they were to enter this male-only chamber, would change the mores, both the kind of day-to-day habits like smoking, but more importantly, that got to a deeper issue, which is, are women going to attempt to clean up politics in Harrisburg? And there was a real concern that these women, although they represented a minority, would somehow push the state house in a direction that at least the controlling machines did not want to go in. So it was a really interesting few months, and what I focused on in our research was what happened during that first legislative year that these women were sitting on the floor. And it, even though it was a moment in time, it really kind of allowed us to see kind of the broader patterns that really are repeated, you know, in the decades since then. And that women, although they were able to unite together in a few instances, by and large, during that first legislative season, they divided along not party lines, but along local faction lines. Some women, for instance, were in favor of Gifford Pinchot, who was then the then incoming Republican governor, who was in support of of prohibition and also in enforcement of prohibition. Half the women got behind him, but the other half did not, because they were following their legislative district's concerns, which did not always align with women's concerns.
So what were some of the big issues that the Keystone Eight faced when they went to the legislature?
Well, according to the League of Women Voters, which established a legislative agenda that they expected the Keystone Eight to follow and were sorely disappointed when they fragmented, had outlined, in addition to the enforcement of prohibition, and again, prohibition was only as good as the enforcement, especially in a place like Pennsylvania where machines and liquor interests are very closely tied. They also supported increases to public education. Again, this is part of the furthering better government. They also were interested in promoting a state constitution, a new state constitution, in an effort to effectively root out political corruption. As you can imagine, the prevailing powers were not interested in that particular agenda. And so the women were forced effectively to submit to a variety of litmus tests that the League had put forward. And again, a number of them went along with it. There were a number of card-carrying members of the League, including a woman from Chester County, Martha Thomas, who was, in fact, served as treasurer of the League while serving as legislator. So she followed the agenda closely, but many other women did not. So they split along a lot of the important lines that were deemed women's issues. And it was quite interesting to see in this small group how you could see, again, broader patterns that would emerge later in terms of the difficulty of maintaining a women's block in the state legislature.
Very first bill that was introduced once the Keystone Eight were seated was from a state senator in the Lehigh Valley who wanted to repeal part of the 19th Amendment that women would not be allowed to sit on juries for their own protection. Talk about that, if you
will. Yes. That was a really interesting moment. I wasn't familiar with this going in, but we were able to kind of drill down and look at that particular piece of legislation. And yes, this was presented as a piece of protective legislation, because women could serve on juries, that means they would be exposed, especially during criminal trials, to murderers and men who had committed heinous crimes or at least being tried for them. And we need to protect these women. So it was a part of as the senator would have said, a chivalrous effort to protect women. And the women, interestingly enough, saw through that very clearly. And one of the women said, well, your age of chivalry that you're trying to maintain was our era of degradation, and we won't have it. And what's interesting is all eight women, although divided on many other lines, voted against that proposal.
So, Kurt Minor, what is the legacy of the Keystone Eight, that initial class of legislators?
As I look at it, and again, this is a moment in time, and we know to look at history and understand that you need to look at broader patterns. But it was still instructive for me as a kind of microcosm of what must happen, what often does happen in a legislative body when groups try to form across what I guess the more natural divisions, which are legislative districts, and they would have called it then, you know, local interests. And it just shows to me the immense difficulty in bringing these coalitions, especially around gender, together, because as that group revealed, so many of them were, although obviously women, identified with many other groups and allegiances and loyalties, and which unfortunately from the perspective of the League of Women Voters undermine their effectiveness as a group.
You can read more about this in Pennsylvania Heritage magazine. Kurt, the State Museum after suffrage, what more is there on this topic for the rest of the year?
Well, we are, as everyone perhaps knows, we are not physically open, but we have a very active online presence now, and we hope until we are able to reopen that we'll be offering variety of virtual programs on our website, statemuseum.org, and our Facebook page. So we hope to continue to fuel some of those programs around women's suffrage, and hope to see people coming back to the State Museum once we do reopen.
Yeah. Dr. Curtis Miner, Senior History Curator at the State Museum of Pennsylvania. Kurt, always good to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Join Rebecca Carroll for Come Through, featuring conversations about race. She talks with great thinkers, writers, and artists about faith, representation, white fragility, and how it's all playing out in 2020. Listen to Come Through Fridays at 9 on WITF. Today we're talking about after the 19th Amendment was passed 100 years ago this week, and women running for office and becoming more involved in government, not just state government, but the federal government as well. With us on today's program is Dana Brown, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics at Chatham University, retired Republican State Senator Pat Vance of Cumberland County, Democratic State Representative Patty Kim of Dauphin County. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator Vance, I'm going to ask all three of you, but Senator Vance, as you heard Kurt Miner going through that history, what were your thoughts? What are some of the things that kind of stuck out to you?
Well, what really brought to mind was something I hadn't thought about for a while. I was in the House in the 1990s, and there was only, at the back of the House, you had to push this door open, get out of the way to shut it, because there was only one little bathroom for women, because obviously they had never anticipated there being a lot of women. And the other thing that reminded me, there was always barbers for men to get their hair, the men legislators to get their hair cut. And it finally ceased, but it took a long time. And I don't know if it was done deliberately or it was just maybe thoughtless. I also happened to be, when I ran for a county office, they had never elected a woman to a county row office. And the questions were not mean-spirited, I don't think. Most of them were, well, what does your husband say? Does he allow you to do this? Who will take care of your children? It was a novelty, and it was something new and different. So the women that came forth in the suffrage movement were incredibly strong, strong women.
Representative Patty Kim, what did you think about some of that history? Was there anything that really stuck out to you?
Sure. I was fortunate to get a tour by Dr. Curtis Miner at the State Museum, and I am so disappointed, you know, obviously with the pandemic and that not more people could walk through it.
Yeah.
But I learned from his tour that the first time where they tried to push the rights, it was 100 years before it actually happened. So the women who started it didn't see the results because obviously they didn't, we weren't around. But to take 100 years for a movement was just kind of humbling and gave me some perspective on the things that I'm trying to push. You know, I hope it doesn't take 100 years to pass minimum wage, but, you know, it takes a long time to change people's minds. And it was so inspiring. You know, I took pictures of the first eight. You know, what in the world did they have to go through to serve, and then I am so grateful for people like Senator Vance, who paved the way for me, and having to go through a lot of things that, you know, were probably inappropriate and uncomfortable, but to stay, and I know that Professor Brown has all the great numbers, but now we have, you know, 64 women in the House, in the General Assembly, 52 in the House, And the dynamics have changed because we did have a huge influx of women, especially in the Southeast, come to serve. And just the dynamics in the caucus has changed. It's calmed down. The decorum is good. The women tend to share their experiences to really hit home why legislation is important to them. So showing vulnerability is so good when, you know, we have to serve different people. Empathy is good in leadership. And it's just, I think it's changed the way we put forth bills and the way we look at them. So I think it's been a huge improvement with more women in the legislature.
Dana Brown, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics. I'm sure you are well aware of a lot of that history, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country after the 19th Amendment. But as Kurt Minor was describing this history in Pennsylvania, what stuck out to you? Professor Brown, are you there?
Yes, hello?
Oh, okay. I was going to say, Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, I can.
Okay. What stuck out to you as Kurt Minor was describing that history here in Pennsylvania?
Well, one thing that I wanted to discuss with us more broadly is, while we're celebrating the suffrage centennial, and rightly so, I just want to remind everyone tuning in today that that suffrage centennial is indeed largely for white women. We know that Black women, Asian American women, Latina, many women of color were still excluded from the right to vote in terms of actual like logistics of being able to do it from poll taxes and Jim Crow laws. So really it wasn't until the Voting Rights Act just a short 55 years ago that we can really embrace universal suffrage. And certainly still today, we see some attempts at voter suppression in various ways. So I just want to remind folks that the history is certainly a challenging one to tell because women are not homogeneous. And so it's a longer story to tell, certainly.
Can I interrupt for just 1 second and follow up on that point? Because, yeah. You know, I fully expected to, you know, to talk about that as well. While we are so, and like almost all history, it is not just, 100% one way, 100% another way. There are, the what ifs and, you know, that kind of thing. But, yeah, as we celebrate this 100th anniversary, and it is a huge celebration and a reason to be celebrated, as you point out, it took to 1965, the Voting Rights Act, for all women to get the right to vote. You know, that probably surprises a lot of people to hear that because they've been hearing so much about 100 years ago, and they just assumed all women had the right to vote and were able to vote. And it took another 45 years for all women to get that right to vote. When you were talking about Jim Crow laws, here in Pennsylvania, are you aware of voter suppression of women of color here in Pennsylvania?
There is voter suppression of women of color sort of across the board in various rates. And we know two Asian American women sometimes were not necessarily citizens, and so they too were excluded from the franchise. And so we know that in order for us to fully embrace and talk about universal suffrage, that really doesn't happen, you know, until the Voting Rights Act is my point. And so many women of color were actually very much a part of the early suffrage movement, working alongside the early suffragists, but yet oftentimes in an effort to increase support, particularly down in the South, for women's suffrage, there were attempts made to kind of signal, like, you know, if you allow white women the right to vote, then that may shore up, you know, basically white supremacy here. Right, there's other ways in which to do this. So there were sometimes subtle and sometimes not so subtle efforts to play upon those racist fears. So it's a very complicated history and one that I think that we're still learning about.
So were there women of color who ran for office, though?
I imagine so, but I can't say for certain. I do not know their names.
Mm-hmm. But there were women of color who probably did run, maybe in some places more than others. I want to go back to Senator Vance and Representative Kim. You know, when Kurt Minor was describing how it surprised many people, including the League of Women Voters, that the Keystone Eight, those original eight members of the legislature, did not vote lockstep, you know, on issues that they represented their districts. You know, I kind of had this thought going through my head. So, oh, what a concept. A legislator that represented their district. So, Senator Vance, when you heard that, what did you think that, you know, it surprised people that those eight women did not vote solidly along the same lines?
Actually, I was proud of them that they didn't. I had never joined a woman's caucus because I believed I was there to represent everyone and not just to have an exclusive group. I know there are other people who would disagree that they think that we should have women's caucuses, but I don't think we should. We should have united caucuses to change. And you obviously are there to represent your own district.
Representative Kim, I don't know whether you're a member of a women's caucus, if there is such a thing in Pennsylvania now, but representing your own district, I don't know, I just had to kind of smile that they would be surprised that women would do that, that elected representatives would do that.
Right. You know, I guess you would just assume they would be in lockstep, but that is just a microcosm of what's going on with Pennsylvania and why it is so difficult for us to pass bills. And, you know, I'm stepping away from the women's legislators, unfortunately, right now. But because I see the divide of urban legislators and rural legislators, it's just we're stuck. And one of my ideas is to, you know, if I was Speaker of the House one day, would be to pair rural and urban legislators and have them each spend time, not just a visit for a policy hearing, but spend time in their communities for a period of time, whether it be sitting around their kitchen table and talking with their families and see the similarities, the humanity in each of them. That one is not evil because they are protecting farmers, and one is not evil for wanting gun reform to help protect the neighborhood kids. And what I thought, you know, during this whole Black Lives Matter movement was when Representative Chris Rabb, African American from Philadelphia, and Stephen Kinsey, African American in Philadelphia, they weren't talking about Black Lives Matters, but they were talking about how Representative's daughter just died and wanted to thank the General Assembly for all of the condolences. And he cried on the House floor. You know, I think it's hard for some people to show those emotions, but it showed his humanity and that if all of us had a daughter who passed away, we would all feel that same profound pain. To bring us all together, and then at that starting point, we can look at legislation and look at each other's, you know, differences and to put good stuff forward. And I just think that's so important and the perspective. And, of course, the women were going to be in lockstep with each other. But we can find our similarities moving forward.
Dana Brown, why would that surprise people that eight women would not vote the same or would not have the same issues as their priorities?
Women are not a monolithic entity. We've known that for quite some time, although there was that immediate expectation after suffrage that women were indeed a voting bloc. And obviously that did not materialize, at least initially. But because of the expectation, sometimes there were some legislative packages put forth with the idea that perhaps that women voters would be supportive of. But we know it did take quite a long time for us to see a gender gap emerge. It took many decades. The 1980 is really one of the first times we start to really track and see a consistent gender gap between men and women in terms of voter identification, meaning the Democratic Party tends to bring more women with them and the Republican Party more men. So there's party identification, and then there's also vote choice. So since 1980, we've had a pretty sizable gender gap in terms of vote choice amongst men and women. Again, women choosing the Democratic nominee over the Republican. And lastly, in terms of policy preferences, we know that certainly in terms of, I don't like to use the term welfare, but welfare bills or government support, violence, right, acts of violence, whether it's domestic or sending military abroad, women and men typically tend to poll very differently on those issues. So that's the thing. Between 1920 and 1980, we actually do start to slowly see this gender gap emerge that was anticipated. But still, certainly women are not, right? Women are not a voting bloc still, even with that bit of a gender gap emerging.
Senator Vance, I'm curious, and you can talk about how things changed over the time you were in the House and then in the Senate over the years. But were there issues that you could see a real difference between men and women legislators?
A specific issue, I think that they tended to relegate women initially, at least, to child care issues, and then gradually education issues. Health became an issue that women were very outspoken about because it was so necessary, but it affected everyone. Some issues were pushed because they were needed, and others were avoided if they could be. And unfortunately, that's true.
Like what? Go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I'm sorry. What were you saying?
I was going to say, well, what issues were avoided? And then we'll get back to what you were saying. I'd like to comment on.
Oh, social issues, I think. A lot of social issues. Let's not bring those up. Let's not talk about that. And since the decision of whether a bill comes up for a vote or not is made by leadership, and the leadership was male, that was a pretty easy way to get around the subject. I was going to say I was struck. I still am old enough, I guess, to get that paper delivered. The two papers in my area this morning, one had a picture of Kamala Harris and her speech last night. The other, you had to go to page 7 to even find it mentioned, which I just thought was kind of ironic. But is this what makes people think? It's what's delivered to them in the press? At least is one thought. I was very surprised. There was nothing at all until page 7.
That is surprising. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Since the killing of George Floyd in an arrest by Minneapolis police on May 25th, the summer has unfolded with an outpouring of grief, anger, and calls to action. NPR has produced The Summer of Racial Reckoning, comprising reporting on racial injustice, the protests that have swept the country, and where the nation is headed. The three-part series airs Monday to Wednesday next week on WITF. We're talking about after suffrage, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, giving women the right to vote, to serve on juries, to run for office, to be taxed. I'm sure that's one that a lot of women really appreciated. It was 100 years ago this week. Tennessee was the final state that approved the 19th Amendment, making it become law and part of our Constitution. Our guest today, Dana Brown, who is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics at Chatham University, retired Republican Senator Pat Vance of Cumberland County, and Democratic State Representative Patty Kim of Dauphin County. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at @smarttalkWITF. Again, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to the telephone now. We have a phone call from Pat. Pat, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. Yes, Tennessee put us over the top. It's Patricia, but you may call me Pat.
Oh, okay.
And we tour capitals, and we went to the new and the old capital in Tennessee and got a wonderful tour. And that's where we heard the story of the young gentleman that was in the legislature and how his mother was in, I guess, the balcony, and she was wearing a flower. And she said to her son, you know, you look up here at me, and you just better vote for the women. And he did. He's the young man that put it over the top.
Yeah, that is a famous story that has been told a lot during this anniversary year of 1920. And that one vote, as you described, is what put it over the top. Now, it eventually probably would have happened, but still, to think about that the legislator's mother put him over the top. Thank you very much, for Patricia, for pointing out that history. Dana Brown, I mean, we kind of just smile at that, but still, it shows in 1920, still, even after, Seneca Falls, the first meeting of women suffragists in 1848, that it took a long time for women to get to that point, and in Tennessee, at least, it took a legislator's mother to put it over the top. I don't know, something like that. It just, I think about it and just think about how history works.
Yeah, I mean, what a great story that is. We know he was wearing his red flower that day, as the antis did, you know, and the folks who were supporting suffrage wore yellow. And there he was on the State House floor receiving this letter, this note from his mother to be a good boy and do the right thing. And then he takes off his flower, right, rather dramatically. And this is the stuff that's sort of made for movies. you can't make that up, that lovely story.
Representative Kim, are there legislators who are following the wishes of their mother today in Pennsylvania?
I haven't surveyed them recently, but I know that spouses and families really help mold their perspectives on things. And I just wanted to give Professor Brown a kudos for all the work that she's doing. And she always brings, you know, women students to the Capitol and asks some of us to speak. And what is on my mind all the time is the way the women, the young students, college students, look at us. And just, you know, I don't want to have this conversation without yesterday's historic moment with Kamala Harris, where I personally, you know, can relate to her, whether it be her mother dying of cancer. I had that unfortunate experience, to somebody who looks like me. And it is so important to put people of color, people of different, you know, genders in front of our students so that they can see themselves in those positions.
And
so
that's why
even today.
Oh, yeah.
And so the Keystone 8, you know, they had nothing to go on, but except for the fire in their bellies and their fierceness to get on the ballot and win. And so I just appreciate Dana's work and the importance of, you know, showing us what we can do.
You know, Representative Kim, I'll address this to you first, but there are a record number of women that are running this year. But as I pointed out in my introduction, still, there are far fewer women elected to office than men. Why?
I think that there's a combination. You know, I didn't want to be in politics because when I was in high school, I'd watch the news and it was disgusting. I didn't want to be in that arena. You know, the fighting, the rough and tumble, like, you know, we were talking about earlier. But then, you know, as I got closer and I realized what the steps were, it was something that I could do. And unfortunately, I didn't see a woman to inspire me. It was a guy asking me to run, and then my husband, you know, he ran for city council before and help me with my campaign. So this is not a male-bashing session. We see the important roles of men in our lives and how they support us. For me, you know, if I could add some culture, you know, as an Asian American in my culture, you know, being modest, not making waves, was conforming, was rewarded. And it took some personal
changes in perspective to be like, you know what, Patty, we need change. The city of Harrisburg needs help. You know, why are you looking at everyone else? Why not me? Why don't you do it? And so I had to make that scary step of, like, I felt like, you know, walking off a cliff because it was just unknown and it could be embarrassing. And I had to ask strangers for money. So there were some challenges that everybody goes through. But when you see other women doing it and succeeding and realizing it's not the end of the world, more women are getting into the races. And so we as women have to be supportive and encouraging, being like, you know, I'll be with you. It's not that scary. And if you get hit, it's going to hurt. But you get over it and move forward, and it helps a lot. We just need to be more supportive of each other as well.
Senator Vance, why do you think that there still are many more men elected than women?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. First of all, and it's kind of ironic that 52% of the voters in Pennsylvania are women, but I believe that more and more women think that they can do it. And they have been joined by the political parties because they see that women are doing well, that women are winning elections. And I think those of us who were elected earlier always felt obligated to be not just as good as, but to be better than, so people would have confidence that the ability was there to justly represent the people.
So you felt that you had to work harder than a man?
Absolutely. There's no question about that.
Representative Kim, you feel the same way?
Absolutely. You know, Senator Vance, you know, had a career before politics. You know, so she had credibility. She was a nurse, or she is a nurse, and that brought something to the table. But for other people, you know, where you had, I just feel frustrated because there's 203 of us, you know, in the House, and you have to stand out, and, you know, you can't be the, you know, the pretty nice person, you know, who, you know, doesn't add anything. You have to show grit. You have to show that you deserve to belong at the table. So it was a fight to get in, and then it's a fight to be at the table in terms of leadership and whatnot.
And
so, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I just said and respected.
And respected, yes. Yes.
Dana Brown, you know, one, and I go back to, well, let me say, I go back to, maybe it's still something that women candidates hear, but when women, you were talking about the 1980s, it was common that a woman running for office would hear, well, who's going to take care of the kids? And mm-hmm. Senator Vance mentioned, well, what's your husband think about this? Those are the kind of questions that male candidates wouldn't be asked. Are those kind of questions still being asked of women? Are there still voters out there who think that women, you know, are not good candidates because they have other responsibilities?
The short answer is yes. I know because I had a recent conversation during the primaries with a younger woman running for a state house seat, and she has a young family. And she was asked while doing like sort of like these virtual events how she was going to handle that should she end up winning the seat. And this is not the first time I've heard this. Actually, there was a younger woman of color too running in the suburbs of Pittsburgh. She's in a biracial marriage. She's of Indian descent, and she has a white husband. And she learned early on while door knocking a couple of years ago that it was actually helpful to have him there kind of in the background. So when folks asked her those kinds of questions, he was actually there in support of her, saying, you know, we're doing this as a team, and et cetera. So sadly, those questions are still asked, hopefully a little less so. Right? Hopefully a little less so, but it is still out there. And, you know, I run a campaign training, maybe a little bit like the League of Women Voters did. So we have a nonpartisan training called Ready to Run, where we actually openly discuss some of these things and how the campaign trail is gendered and what women candidates can expect and perhaps how to kind of navigate some of those gendered situations.
Here's one that is, maybe people won't talk about it as much, but you wonder, I wonder whether it still happens or not. Are women, I talked about those Keystone 8 and the press commenting on their appearance. Does that still happen with women candidates?
Much less so. So the political science on this indicates that, particularly in the last 10 years, 10, 12 years, there's been a real decline in mentioning outfits, hair, you know, presentation of self. There's been a decline in that for women. But at the same time, women candidates are still more likely to have character traits discussed in the press, things like someone's laugh or their disposition, much more likely that is to come out in an article as opposed to men. And we actually do still find that there are actually just more time spent on public policy issues with male candidates as opposed to women. So men are still getting more quote-unquote press about the public policy, and that matters, right? You can imagine you're Senator Vance was talking about getting the paper, and you're reading these stories about what Joe, you know, is going to do. I shouldn't say Joe. There's a real candidate named Joe now. So that's more like the call. Jimmy John.
Jimmy John.
Yeah, I don't know. So what Tom is running on, there will be more actual print and time spent on Tom's issues as opposed to Sally, for example. And so that certainly matters when you're reading it. But the good news is that there's certainly less on presentation of self.
Why is
Scott,
that?
Scott, yes, can ahead. I chime in a little bit? A gentleman who I respected said something that was kind of shocking. So back in the 1920s, women were probably considered to be to run the house and the kids, and that's it. Fast forward to 2020, after the presidential elections with all the women running, you know, he told me that Senator Warren was just too confident. I was just like, oh, my God, how the world has changed. Like, that was a bad thing to have somebody too strong and too, you know, when Kamala Harris was going after Joe Biden, you know, it was hard to watch and people didn't like that. And, you know, if men did the same thing, it'd be like, oh, well, that's politics. So I think women have to be worried. I'm joking, you know, that we're too confident and that, you know, we need to, it's laughable. It's seriously, it's laughable that was a comment. So
I actually heard that too. And it is laughable that you would hear that a candidate for president was too competent. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Senator Vance, you mentioned something that is very important. You said 52% of the electorate here in Pennsylvania, women do vote more than men in Pennsylvania, at least, and I think across the country that holds true. Does it mean that there will be more women candidates going forward?
I don't think necessarily. I'm always chagrined when I hear some of my friends say, when they're talking about the election, well, John says or Steve says, and I always say, but what do you think? And I wonder how many of them are thinking independently.
All right. Dana Brown, what about that? I mean, with the majority of the voters being women, you would think there would be more women candidates.
And there are. We are in another record-breaking year of women running, and that kind of holds true for Pennsylvania as well. And so I do anticipate as more women run, more women will win. We know historically that women win at the same race as men. I think the same type of seat, right? If it's an open seat, you have just the same chance as a man. If you're an incumbent or a challenger, you have the same chance as a man. So I'm extremely hopeful, you know, to go from that Keystone 8, and now we're up to about 27% of the legislature being women. That's an improvement, a slow one. It's been slow, but we know progress is slow, but we will get there. I am eternally optimistic.
I want to thank all three of you for being with us. State Representative Patty Kim, former State Senator Pat Vance, Dana Brown of Chatham University. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.